Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, as we approach All Hallows' Eve, we have dedicated the next hour to ghost tales and dark legends. Award-winning writer Scott McClanahan remembers hearing scary tales while growing up in Greenbrier County, West Virginia.
The ghost appears that night in front of the mother, in front of the sheriff.
Mark Harshman will tell the legend of Ghost Train.
You've got to remember, this all happens just a few seconds, you know, 2, 3, 4 seconds, not much more than that. And all of a sudden, just those two trains were to collide, it vanished.
Judy Byers tells us about a coal miner's ghost who supposedly helped trapped miners find safety above ground.
All of a sudden, there was an explosion. Boom! And this particular group of miners was trapped.
Suspend your disbelief and travel to a place where imagination and folklore are alive and well. Welcome to this special edition of Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is our Halloween episode where we pay tribute to that fine Appalachian tradition of spooky storytelling. For me, though, I grew up hearing about demons, not ghosts, in a Christian home. I remember my mother sharing a story of her childhood. There was a woman in the Pentecostal church she attended as a kid. The churchwoman said she had cast out a demon from someone and could describe the look of the spirit with great detail, like a wrinkled paper bag with nails that curled, they were so long. The churchwoman said after casting out the demon, it came to her doorstep, scratching with those long nails, looking for the next place to possess. Of course, it was prayer and the power of God, I was told, that kept the evil at bay. It was a terrifying story that I still remember. Now, I'm not a fan of scary movies and I could go without ghost tours, but there is something about telling or listening to ghost tales around a campfire that evokes emotion, intrigue, and curiosity at the least. Take this one, for example.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door.
That was Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, recited by Joey Medea during a recent one-man show that took place in none other than the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in Weston, West Virginia. The building markets itself to folks looking for a good scare and even offers zombie paintball to visitors. There are many places like this throughout Appalachia. Places with the reputation for being the scene of scary monsters and ghost tales. And there is something about the mountains of Appalachia that creates such a rich setting for spectral visions. As we worked on this episode, we began to see one theme, that with most of these ghost stories, the details all depend on the teller. Folklore has a way of twisting the facts, depending on how they're passed down. And true or not, there is something really interesting and entertaining about the stories that we tell year after year. We'll begin with this one, the Greenbrier Ghost. It's Scott McClanahan's childhood scary story. He's a fiction writer who grew up in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, listening to the legendary tale about a ghost who actually helped convict her own murderous husband. McClanahan grew up in Raynell, just a few miles from the place where the murder of Zona Heaster took place.
All right. Well, the story of the Greenbrier Ghost, let me see. I guess there's like so many different like variations of the story. I'll just tell like the story the way that I heard it when I was a kid. And the way that I heard it was a kid, there's this one girl named Zona who grew up kind of close to where I grew up. So there was this girl named Zona, and she was a farm girl. Remember this farm family. And one day, this guy named Trout had come into the community, into the farm community. They get married, have a home of their own. He's kind of taken her away from the family somewhat, I guess. There's kind of a rift between Zona and her family because they don't get along with Trout. She starts becoming ill over the course of time. And the family knows this. And this takes place over the course of months. One day Trout is at work, and he's a blacksmith in this community, and he sends a child back to check on Zona to make sure she's okay. What the child finds is that Zona is dead at the foot of the stairs of the farmhouse. So he runs all the way back to where Trout is doing his blacksmith work. Zona's dead, and they're going to prepare her for burial. But Trout won't allow the women of the community to help. He does it all himself. He dresses her in the dress that he wants her in. He places like a thick ribbon around her neck. And then during the ceremony, he sits at her head and won't allow anyone to come around the body. They take that as the fact that he's in such grief and such despair that he's weeping and crying over the body of his wife. The body's buried. Zona's family goes back to their home. Time passes, and then one night Zona's mother, she awakes, and she sees her daughter, a ghost of her daughter, at the foot of her bed. And the ghost says, "I didn't die the way he said I died. I wasn't just sick and passed away. He murdered me. He broke my neck." The mother goes to sleep. The next night, she wakes up again. At the foot of her bed is her daughter, the apparition of her daughter's form, saying, "He killed me and murdered me. Help." The way I heard it then, she goes and gets the sheriff, which maybe makes the story a little bit more plausible too. She goes and gets the sheriff, who comes and stays in the home. And the ghost appears that night in front of the mother, in front of the sheriff. So the sheriff demands like an exhumation of the body. Dr. Rupert, who is named, or a local community is named after him, is the one who does the exhumation, and they find through this process that indeed Zona's neck had been broken. She hadn't just been sick. She hadn't just been ill. Trout is actually tried for the murder of his wife. The mother comes and testifies in Lewisburg that this ghost of her daughter had appeared to her on multiple nights, telling her what happened. And of course, they have the medical records from the exhumation to back her up, that the story is corroborated by the records of the exhumation. This is the reason why on the sign that they say, you know, this is the only court case in the United States legal history where a ghost has helped try and convict someone of murder. They rebury the body. Trout is convicted. He's sent to Moundsville. And while at Moundsville, he is a carpenter there. And he is building coffins for the convicts, for the prisoners who die. Many years later, he hatches this plot to escape, where he is going to build a coffin. Once one of the prisoners dies, he's going to place himself within the coffin, have someone nail him up inside the coffin. They'll take the coffin to the outside, have it buried in the cemetery of the prisoners who have passed on. He has also contacted someone who is outside the prison, one of his buddies, to come and dig up the coffin so that he can escape. And that's exactly what happens. They have a burial of one of the prisoners on the date and on the time. The friend is there. After everyone is gone, he comes, digs up the coffin, and Trout is free. And then from that point on, nobody knows what happens to Trout. He just simply kind of wanders like a ghost himself.
The That was Scott McClanahan, who's also working on a film about Greenbrier Ghost, which is set to be released in the next year or so by $2 Radio Moving Pictures. You can see a trailer for that film on our website, wvpublic.org. McClanahan was also one of two authors who won the Thomas and Lily D. Chafin Award in Appalachian Writing. McClanahan recently traveled to Morehead State University in Kentucky to receive that award. The small town of Middleway, West Virginia, in the eastern panhandle, is home to just around 450 people. Many of these families have been in this town for generations, dating back as far as the 1770s. Visitors who stop through the town today might see symbols of a pair of scissors and half-moon crescents on various signs, buildings, and even homes. These symbols come from a legend the town holds dear that dates back to the 1790s. It's the legend of Wizard Clip. To find out more about this story, reporter Liz McCormick asked Peter Fricka to explain the famous legend. Peter was born in England and moved to West Virginia in 1989. The story begins with a farmer from Pennsylvania looking to start anew in Middleway.
The story really begins in about 1780, when a man by the name of Adam Livingston, living in Pennsylvania, a staunch Lutheran with a large family, started having some problems on the farms. And his farm, his barn burned, he lost cattle, his crops failed, and he decided that maybe he should try some new land, and so he moved south in about 1790 into the Middleway area. And he took up a large portion of land on the east bank of the Opequon, immediately south of what is now State Road 51, and north of the road that was then the main road through the area, Bunker Hill Road. Everything begins with a stranger asking for lodging at the Livingstones. The inns in the town were full, and he was on his way probably to Martinsburg, and he needed some lodging. So he stopped at the Livingstones. Some say he was just there for one night. Some say he was there for several nights. And during this time, the Livingstones never discovered what his name was, and they never discovered exactly who he was and what he did and where he was going and where he was from. So he remained a mystery man, although they conversed with him quite a bit. During the night, one of the nights that he was there, the last night he was there, this gentleman fell ill and asked for a priest. And Mrs. Livingston, being a staunch Lutheran, and her husband being equally staunch, said, "No Romanist priests in my house," and forbade her husband to go looking for a local Catholic priest. And, of course, since these were itinerant priests at the time, that would have been very difficult to find one on the fly anyway. So the gentleman next morning was dead. A whole series of manifestations began to happen. Ducks and geese would be walking along, and all their legs would fall off. Or chickens would be out in the yard, and the heads would be chopped off as if by a scythe sweeping through the air. People would come into the house, and their clothes would be cut, as if somebody was using a large pair of scissors. And the sound of scissors and shears through the house was something that marked it. And it was well documented. People noted, you know, you don't keep something quiet like that around a small place like this. So at this point, Mr. Livingston was quite beside himself, of course. This went on for several months. And he started looking around for a minister, since he was Lutheran, who could help him in this, because he came to the conclusion after reading the Bible that this was a diabolical series of exercises. and none of them were able to help him. Some of them came and prayed and read with him, but all this still continued on. At this point, Mr. Livingston had a dream, and in the dream it showed somebody wearing robes who was chanting. And he believed that that person in that dream was the person who could help him. So first of all, he went to Winchester to an Episcopal priest there, because Episcopal priests wore robes. The Episcopal priest wasn't able to help him. So then he came back and met with a family called McSherry, who were the local Catholic family. They lived just outside Leetown, which is about 4 or 5 miles to the north of here. And McSherry said, you need to talk to the priest up in Shepherdstown. We have a service there next week. The visiting priest is coming, and there'll be a service in a house in Shepherdstown. And so he went. And when he walked in, he saw the priest in his robes, and he said, that's the man in my dream. And he asked the priest if he would come to Middleway and do an exorcism of the house. What we do know is that the priest that Mr. Livingston went to see in Shepherdstown, the Father Dennis Cahill, was in fact visiting there, and he did come down. And the first time he came down, he said a few prayers and sprinkled some holy water around, and everything quietened down for several days. He then came back when the emanations began again and proceeded to conduct a mass on the site, and also proceeded to go over the property with Mr. Livingston and identify the various graves that were there on the property, because there were graves on the property, and created a consecrated graveyard. So at that point, all the hauntings ended.
This is just one story involving the legend of Wizard Clip. There are, in fact, two tales, one involving a mysterious traveler, as you heard, who some say was a tailor, given the nature of the way things were clipped. The other involving no traveler at all, just a haunting that followed the Livingstons relentlessly until an exorcism by a Catholic priest put everything to rest. The legend is so deeply rooted in the identity of the town that to this day, the townspeople still argue on which story is the truth or whether anything happened at all.
Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. He'll come to your house and you won't stay long. You look in the bed and somebody will be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Well, death will go in any family in this land. And death will go in every family in this land. He'll come to your house and he won't stay long. You look in the bed and one of your family will be gone. Death will go in every family in this land. Well, he never takes a vacation in this land. You know, death never takes a vacation in this land.
For this next story, we head to the coal camps in Granttown, West Virginia, where at one time the Federal Coal and Coke Company operated the largest underground coal mine in the world. Folklorist Ruth Ann Music said, "The dark passageways of the coal mines are likely places for ghosts. By and large, they are friendly souls, neither violent nor malevolent, who come back to see how things are getting along and to lend a helping hand when needed." Although the mine at Granttown is now closed and Ruth Ann Music has since passed away, people still tell the tales that she collected. In honor of Halloween, reporter Roxy Todd asked folklorist Dr. Judy Byers for her favorite ghost story. And here's what she said.
Jim Clyburn said that my grandfather was a coal miner all of his life. He had started to work in the coal mines of Wales when he was only 11 years old. He told me many of his experiences in the mines, and some of which Jim found quite hard to believe, but there was one tale that stood out, and this is the tale that will comprise Big John's ghost. It was about a big Russian coal miner and an accident that took place when the Granttown mine was just getting started. Now, Grandpa called him Big John because that's what all the other men called him. They really didn't know his last name, and that was very typical of coal mining. The names, especially if they were ethnic names and could not be easily Anglicized, were sometimes just forgotten. They also called him Big John because he was a huge man. And Jim said that Grandpa felt that everyone loved him because Big John carried his weight. He often would help the other miners when they were not strong enough to lift the coal piles, literally, or the equipment, the hand equipment. And he also loved to talk. He loved to talk. He knew some English, and that he kept practicing and practicing. Well, Grandpa worked with Big John all day, every day. And what they did together was they did the fire in the hole, which is a typical way of traditionally blowing, dynamiting to loosen the coal from the rock. John would plant the charges to blow out the coal, and Jim said Grandpa would fix the plunger. Well, one day, John was planting the dynamite in a vein of coal, and Grandpa was around the corner, fixing the plunger that detonated the charge. Well, all of a sudden, he heard an explosion and a terrible scream, and he ran around the corner to find Big John lying on the ground with his head completely blown off. A stick of dynamite had accidentally gone off. Well, it was a terrible shock to Grandpa, Jim said, for he and John had become close friends. And it seemed as if, as he looked down and didn't know what to do to help him, that he almost could hear John talking and laughing. And that's what he remembered. Now he was gone. Well, as the story goes, one foggy morning, just about a month after the accident, Grandpa was going down in the cage alone, the cage that he and Big John had occupied together when they went down to do their special work with that fire in the hole technique. All of a sudden, Grandpa felt as if he were not alone. He slowly turned around, and there before his eyes stood Big John. But he was holding his head under his left arm. And the head was laughing, smiling, and it spoke to Grandpa. Just did it always did when it was on Big John's shoulders. Well, Grandpa shut his eyes, rubbed his eyes, and kept them shut until that cage hit the bottom. when he opened them again, Big John was gone. Well, Grandpa told that story to all the other miners back in that area. And he told it up on land. He told it so often that after a while, people were a little uncomfortable and they didn't really want him to talk about it anymore. Well, in the archives here at the Folklife Center, where we keep Ruth Ann Music's holdings of all these wonderful, wonderful tales, there's a version of this. It's really actually a variant, an addition. And it didn't get put in the story, but I've always been fascinated by it. And in that addition, that variant, it is said that it was a couple of months then after the initial explosion and after Jim's grandfather had this encounter, that a group of miners went down into that area to work. And while they were detonating, taking out the coal, piling it, all of a sudden, there was an explosion. It was more of a landslide. Boom! And this particular group of miners was trapped behind the coal. Now, they figured they knew exactly where they were, and they knew to a certain point how far back the portal vein went. But still, they were trapped. And as the story goes, some started praying. Some reached into those lunch buckets and the pepperoni buns were already gone. But the pieces of pie and cake were still there. For every miner wanted to take those desserts back home to their young'uns, and when the miners did, that meant another day of not an accident, and the sweet was so good for the children. So some started doing that. Others began to cry. But in the midst of all of that, there was probably more praying. And as the time went by, one man, and then another, for there were about nine of them. They noticed a winking of a light. But the light was kind of oozing underneath the stack of coal and debris. And then they heard a chuckle. And then they heard a laugh. And by golly, it was the voice, that broken English of that big Russian miner. And as they looked around, that light spread out from under that pile of coal. And standing before them was Big John, with the head laughing, tucked under the left arm. Well, the miner said, "John, can you help us? Can you help us? We're trapped. We're trapped." Well, in his right hand was a lantern, and it spread that light all the way around. And he said, "Follow. Follow me." And they didn't think there was anywhere to go, but somehow there was an opening. Out beyond that coal pile. And they followed him. And lo and behold, they came to where the cage was. And they all scrambled in that cage, really too many for one cage, but they were going in it. And it is said, as they saw John put down the lantern, reached up, pulled down the chain, and the cage went up. Now, that's what those men told everyone waiting there at the top. Because, you see, the men at the top and even the wives knew there had been a bit of an explosion down underneath. And they feared for their lives.
This story is still told by many residents of Granttown, and it was originally recorded by Ruth Ann Music. Dr. Judy Byers directs the Folklife Center at Fairmont State, which houses all of Music's tales that she collected in West Virginia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is Inside Appalachia. This is our Halloween episode where we pay tribute to that fine Appalachian tradition of spooky storytelling. A couple years ago, Roxy Todd with West Virginia Public Radio was living in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, where many people say they've seen panthers. The Department of Natural Resources claims that mountain lions have been extinct in West Virginia for over 100 years, but the tales continue to be told. Roxy recorded many of these stories, including this one, at the house of her neighbor and friend, Iva Williams.
A long black tail, yellow eyes. I scream in the woods at night. In 2012, I was living up on Droop Mountain, about a quarter mile away from Iva Williams. She's in her 70s and makes a fantastic hot pepper jelly. Many times that winter, I felt like Iva was my best friend up on that lonely, cold mountain. I walked to her house one night when she had some of her family over to play old-time music. She sang and played the guitar, Carter family tunes mostly. At one point, she set down her guitar and told me about growing up just a stone's throw away from the Cranberry Wilderness. Her son-in-law, Danny, came by too, and it turned out that they each had a similar story about a black cat with a long black tail.
I'm Iva Williams, and I live on Droop Mountain. Been living in West Virginia all my life. Born and raised on Stamping Creek. While we were living up there, my baby brother was born. March 28, 1950. And my mother got sick, and she was wanting somebody to get up and sit with her because she kept hearing a noise that she didn't know what was. Of course, I knew very little to do, not even being quite 10 years old, but I had some water and whatnot and was trying to bathe her face, and I sat there to way up in the morning hours, and she finally came to her senses, and she said, would you get in down here at the foot of my bed and stay right here so I could wake you up if I needed to? And I said, yes, so I did, and I went right straight to sleep.
Okay, my name is Daniel McLaughlin. Probably when I was about 12 years old, I lived at Swago, which is a little road off to the side from Buckeye, West Virginia. Probably about 5 miles up that road, there's a cave. And we had no running water, so one of my chores was to pack the water in every evening. And we'd take the metal buckets and go over to the cave and had a pipe run out of there that we'd hang the buckets on and fill up with water and take back to the house.
I guess I no more got asleep until she was taking her foot and shaking me awake, and when I roused up, she said, listen, do you hear that? I said, yeah. And she said, well, what is it? I said, I don't know. She says, well, go get your daddy.
And what was it? What was the sound?
It was clawing and scratching, but what happened was us children had broke a window out in the kitchen. And she had to put a paste cardboard in the window to keep the cold out, of course, till she could get somewhere to get a glass to put in it. And that's where the sound was coming from. So I jumped out of bed, and I picked up the oil lamp, which she was trying to say, don't do, and get your daddy. And I kept going with the lamp, and when I got to the kitchen door, the table was sitting there, and that window was broke out right there, too. This big old black cat was sitting on the bench clawing at the window.
Anyway, this one particular evening, I went and got water in the water bucket, and I heard this scream just like a wow, you know, now let go of the water bucket and let it go back into the creek and ran home.
But I moved the lamp so I could see it better, you know. It looked in the lamp just for a minute. The bright shine made his eyes glassy and just dived right out the window like he was diving in a pool or something with his arms outstretched. She said, "What is it?" I said, I don't know what it was, but it was a great big cat. And it was. It was a huge old big black cat, and its tail drug right on the floor.
The last mountain lion to be killed in West Virginia was in Pocahontas County in 1887. But in the 1930s, panther tracks were spotted on Kinnison Mountain, where Iva Williams grew up. Mountain lions with colors of beige and gray used to be very common throughout Appalachia. Officially, no black panther has ever been discovered in North America. Maybe the panthers were all killed off. Maybe not. All I know is I walked home from Iva's house that night and listened. And I knew that there were animals out there. I guess I'm an animal too. Not a single car passed me as I walked along the highway and back to my little home.
Many musicians out there will recognize the name of Naomi Wise, sometimes called Omi Wise. The tale often catches the interests of musicians that have played the song over the years, but some people say that the song is based on an actual murder. In fact, in Randolph County, North Carolina, it's believed that a real woman named Naomi Wise was killed by her lover, John Lewis. A grave in North Carolina honors her story. But a West Virginia folklorist, Jerry Milnes, says that another claim to the tale is also in Randolph County, West Virginia. Reporter Jesse Wright Mendoza with the Traveling 219 Project takes us on this strange journey to find out if there could be any truth to the claims.
Oh, listen to my story, I'll tell you no lies. How John Lewis did murder poor little Omi Wise. He told her to meet him down at Adams Springs. He promised her money and other fine things.
That's the beginning of one of the most famous murder ballads in American music. It tells the true story of the murder of Naomi Wise by John Lewis in 1808 in Randolph County, North Carolina.
So fool-like she met him down at Adams Springs. No money he brought her, nor other fine things. Come with me, little Omi, and away we will go. We'll go and get married, and no one will know. She climbed up behind him, and away they did go. But off to the river where deep waters flow.
As the story goes, John Lewis seduced a young and innocent Naomi Wise. When she came to him and told him she was pregnant, he promised her marriage. But instead of becoming his bride, he took her down to the river and drowned her. Jerry Milnes is a folklorist in West Virginia. Years ago, he was approached by a man named Leroy Wingfield, who asked if he knew the song.
And I said, yeah, I'd heard different people sing that. And he said, well, I know where her grave is, on Cheat River.
As in the Cheat River in West Virginia.
That took me by surprise because I had heard of the true history of the original Naomi Wise that took place back in 1808 in North Carolina on the Deep River.
Leroy Wingfield introduced Jerry to Charles and Odie Chapman. All three said not only was Naomi Wise killed in West Virginia, but they also knew the location of her grave.
We're with Lee Wingfield.
Leroy Wingfield.
And Charles and Odie Chapman.
Maybe we can start out, Mr. Wingfield, by just you telling us how you remembered the whole story, who you heard it from, and those kinds of things.
Okay. Back in the Depression days, they'd cut the timber behind, on that hillside behind the grave. So one evening, the last trip down, I'd noticed some roses over in, on the left. And I thought, that's peculiar, roses there in the woods. And I laid my tools down and walked over and found out that it looked like maybe a grave there.
During this interview conducted in 1992, Leroy recalls asking a man named Robert Channel if he knew anything about the grave. Channel said he did know whose grave it was, that it was the grave of a young girl who had been murdered, and that he was there when her body was pulled from the water.
And that's what he told me. He remembered that. He was just a lad that they... And it was a very exciting thing in his lifetime.
Did he definitely name her as Naomi Wise?
Yes.
He did.
I was able to document that Randolph Wise lived in the house that was closest to the grave. Wingfield said that Randolph Wise raised a girl, and she was the one who was murdered and is in the grave on the hillside there above Cheat River.
And he said he thought the reason that they didn't bury her there because she was going to have this child out of wedlock, see, and they didn't want to put her down there in Parsons Cemetery. Mm-hmm. So
could have been.
Those people told them to put her up there on the bank.
Things like this back then just simply was not talked about. It was a total disgrace. No other word for it. Disgrace.
I got into courthouse research and found out about a woman who named Ruhami, which could easily be shortened to Ami or Omi, and there's about 10 or 12 different similar names used for Naomi. She did exist. She died of unknown causes, according to courthouse records, and that there was a nefarious gentleman in the neighborhood who was in hot water with other neighborhood women and had been charged with, I think, 3 or 4 bastardy cases.
A lot of those people came down here to work in the hardwood, you know. And apparently he was a pretty smooth character. Everywhere he would go, she was with him. And, of course, she was quite young. And so anyway, he got in trouble. And so she finally told him that if he didn't marry her, she was going to blow the whistle on him.
John Lewis, John Lewis, will you tell me your mind? Do you intend to marry me or leave me behind? Little old me, little old me, I'll tell you my mind. My mind is to drown you and leave you behind. Have mercy on my baby and spare me my life. I'll go home as a beggar and never be your wife.
He kissed her and hugged her and turned her around, then pushed her in deep waters where he knew that she would drown. He got on his pony.
The country music recording industry plays into this when you get up into the 20th century. And then people like Doc Watson and people who were quite famous, Roscoe Holcomb, I think, recorded it. And along the way, they changed it from Deep River to Cheat River and added their own context to it and their own geography to it. And all of a sudden, it becomes something different than what it started out to be.
These artists probably learned the song from early commercial recordings, which mostly adhered to these later verses.
They threw their net around her and drew her to the bank. Her clothes all wet and muddy, they laid her on a plank.
And that's what's called the folk process. A song is passed down, then written down, then committed to acetate. When it enters popular culture, it's usually very far from where it began.
He made no confession, but they carried him to jail. No
no friends nor relations would go on his bail.
That was Jesse Wright Mendoza, who produced this story with the Traveling 219 Project. Perhaps we'll never know who was really buried in the solitary grave beside the Cheat River in Randolph County, West Virginia. Helping sing the ballad of Naomi Wise was Emily Prentice and Doc Watson. Now let's hitch a ride on a ghost train, or at least the story of a spooky locomotive as told by poet laureate of West Virginia Mark Harshman from Wheeling. We caught up with him last week at the West Virginia Storytellers Guild annual festival at Jackson's Mill. His friend, storyteller Bonnie Collins, first shared this story with Harshman, and she told him it was true.
There used to be a train that ran from Clarksburg, West Virginia, to New Martinsville, called the Short Line. And this story takes place back in the 1920s or 30s. It was the fall of the year. It was evening, that special time of evening when it's almost dark, but not quite completely dark. And that Short Line train was coming into New Martinsville. And it just come around a big horseshoe curve, and ahead of it lay a 2-mile straight stretch of track, single track. And so they were running a little behind, and so the engineer was putting the coal to her and picking up steam, flying down that straight stretch just as fast as he could, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour. When all of a sudden, here came another train straight at them. Headlamp outlined that train. He knew. He recognized the train. He called to the brakeman and set the brake. But in the same moment, he realized, he could judge from the distance, that somehow it was already way too close. And he said to the men, the brakeman and fireman there on the cab, he said, "Look, fellas, you want to jump, go ahead." And the fireman, he jumped. Brakeman stayed to this day. I don't know why. And the engineer, he stayed, I think, sort of like the captain of a ship. He was going to go down with his train. And you've got to remember, this all happens just a few seconds, you know, 2, 3, 4 seconds, not much more than that. And all of a sudden, just those two trains were to collide, it vanished, disappeared. There was no collision. The engineer looked at the brakeman looked at the fireman. They just shrugged their shoulders, didn't know what to say. That fireman, he had jumped, so they brought the train to a stop, climbed down out of the cab, and went back up the tracks to find the fireman, which wasn't too hard. All they had to do was listen for the sound of his moans. He'd broken his leg pretty badly. So they gathered him up, carried him back up on into the cab, and went on into New Martinsville. Well, you know how it is when something really strange and peculiar happens. You don't always go running off somewhere to tell a story about it. And that's the way it was with these men. They thought, maybe we all just seeing things back there. Maybe we all went crazy for the same 4 or 5 seconds. And I think they would just have been as happy to have forgotten all about it. Except that the same thing happened again, 3 nights later. Same run, that Clarksburg into New Martinsville run. Same time of evening, almost dark, but not quite. Coming around that horseshoe bend, picking up steam, flying down that 2-mile straight stretch of track. Same engineer, same brakeman. Different fireman, huh? He was hobbling around town on a pair of crutches. Flying down that track when all of a sudden here came another train straight at them. Now you've got to remember, it was so perfectly real. The headlamp of that other train so perfectly real. The outline of that train so perfectly real. Flying at them just as fast as they were flying back at it. It was not the kind of thing with which you could take a chance. And so again, the engineer cried out to the men to set the brake at the same moment. "Look, fellas, you want to jump, you can." Well, the brakeman, he'd already been through it. And they had told this fireman the story. And so knowing the story, he stayed put as well. And then just as had happened before, just as they were to collide, it vanished, disappeared. There was no collision. And they took the train on into New Martinsville. But this time, now that this same strange thing had happened twice, they weren't quite so inclined to keep shut about it. And so they began to talk. And you can imagine in a small town like New Martinsville, West Virginia, like any of 100 other small towns in our great state, the story grew. And before long, everybody was talking about the ghost train. And it happened a third night and a fourth night. It even got the attention of the sheriff, Now, the sheriff wasn't in the habit of going chasing after ghost stories, but there was a real man hobbling around town on a pair of crutches who had broken his leg, who was a go-to-church-every-Sunday, never-take-a-drop-of-liquor kind of guy, and he jumped from a train for a pretty good reason. So the sheriff gathered some deputies and thought they'd better go take a look. Well, I said this happened in the fall of the year, didn't I? That late summer, before all this happened, they had torn down an old hotel in New Martinsville, one of those grand old hotels like you used to find in places along the Ohio River, like the Wells Inn in Sistersville or the Lafayette in Marietta, Ohio. And as the men were tearing it down one day, they came upon one of those big old hallway mirrors, all edged in gold, only now all black with dirt and soot. But they took care of it, and they laid it out amongst the wreckage, and it happened to be time for their lunch. And so they went off for their lunch. And while they were gone, three older teenage boys happened by, and they seen that mirror, and they decided they was going to have themselves some fun. Well, now, I don't know how they got that mirror hauled up onto the back of their wagon or their old pickup, but I certainly don't know how they got it hauled all that way out into the country, 8 miles to be sure. But eventually, somehow over the next month or two, they got it out there. And here's what happened then when it was time for that fifth appearance of that ghost train. There was the sheriff and his deputies along that 2 mile straight stretch of track, and they heard the whistle of the train. And then they saw the headlamp of that train, the short line train. Then they saw it start to fly down that 2 mile straight stretch of track. And then they saw something else. They saw three shadows come up out of the brush, holding something big and shiny between them. Saw those three boys hold that great big old mirror, hoist it up over the track, hold it up as high over that track as they could, hold onto that mirror as long as they could until that train was almost on top of them. Then they let that mirror slip back to their hands, back down that steep embankment, and back into the brush to hide. Only that night, there was the sheriff and his deputies waiting for them. They hauled those boys off to jail, and I expect they stayed there a good long while back in those days. And that's where the ghost train died. But you see, it was a true story. And the engineer was perfectly right. He'd been seeing a real train. The only thing he had not known was that he was seeing the reflection of his very own train. And that's told as a true story from Wetzel County, West Virginia.
When Harshman first heard the story, he thought it must have really happened in Wetzel County. But as he tells this story across West Virginia, folks insist this ghost story really first happened in their town.
Down at the bottom near those lonesome stones was an old man. He was living there with his rickety-tickety bones.
And he said,
too many years now,
it's been so long,
I've been estranged. Now in my final hours, I am ready to make a change.
And he said,
not gone away,
not gone away,
I'm gonna go. It's not too late, and I'm not gonna wait no more.
Yeah, he said,
not gone away,
not gone away,
I'm gonna go. And I'm not gonna wait no more. He packed up his bags, he dusted off his boots. After all these years locked in here, what have I got to lose? Then it got colder, he saw the shadow of his breath. And when he heard the chill and knocking, well, he knew that it was death.
And death said,
not gone away,
not gone away,
not gonna go. It's too late, and I'm not gonna wait no more.
Yeah, death said,
not gone away,
not gone away,
not gonna go. It's too late, and I'm not gonna wait no more.
Picture, October 31st. As darkness gathers, little fargoers head out in search for tasty treats. By night's end, they'll gorge themselves, growing fat on their bounty. And I'm not even talking about children hunting for Snickers bars. Nope. On today's Allegheny Front Bird Files, we learn about another creature in search of goodies on Halloween, the northern saw-whet owl. That's saw-whet. Possibly named for giving a call that sounds like a saw being sharpened on a whetting stone. Carnegie Museum of Natural History's Luke DeGroat introduces us to the northern saw-whet owl.
Our smallest owl in the eastern United States, the northern saw-whet, is literally the size of a pine glass, a mere 7 inches in height. With a large round head and blazing pumpkin-colored eyes, it is arguably one of the most adorable birds in North America. Nevertheless, saw-whets are frighteningly good as predators. To quote the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where mice and other small mammals are concerned, this fierce owl is anything but cute. Northern saw-whets' favorite prey are mice, but they'll also devour the occasional beetle, bird, or even bat. They begin their nightly breakfast hunts not long after sunset and search for lunch around 2 a.m. They often consume only half their second meal, just the head and shoulders, brains and all, and save the rest for a midday snack. If the stash morsel is frozen, it tucks it under its belly and warms it up before devouring the rest. Each and every fall, many saw-whets migrate south from Canada and the northern U.S. to spend the winters in the balmy southern or central United States. In years after rodent population booms, saw-whets migrate south by the thousands October through November. And what is the median arrival date here in Pennsylvania? You guessed it, Halloween. So while children take to the streets this All Hallows' Eve, researchers will haunt the forests to study this mysterious owl. They'll lure them in with the toot 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 call blared through a car stereo amplifier, speakers, and tractor battery, Frankenstein together. They'll determine the owl's age with ultraviolet lights. Fresh wing feathers are fluorescent under UV light, while older feathers are more gloomy. Finally, the researchers will assess each bird's condition and affix a small numbered metal band to track these birds over time. You don't have to have this special equipment to appreciate the northern saw-whet owl. As you're out walking in the cover of darkness this Halloween, keep an ear out for their eerie fall conversation. You might just hear something spine-chilling.
Luc DeGroat works at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History's Powder Mill Natural Reserve. Bird calls for this segment provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, recorded by David S. Herr. The research work he mentioned is all part of the Project OwlNet. You can see researchers at work at the Ned Smith Nature Center in eastern Pennsylvania and Valley Falls State Park in West Virginia. I'll leave you with one more story that I heard as a child that was truly chilling for a time. My grandfather, or Pawpaw as we called him, insisted that someone must have fallen into the abandoned well in our front yard. It was covered with a removable steel cap. He told me that if you removed the steel cap and hollered into the hole, "What you doing down there?" that you would hear back, "Nothing at all." It took me a while to get that one, but I sure stayed away from that hole. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Traveling 219 Project and the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and storytellers Scott McClanahan, Judy Byers, and Mark Harshman. Music in today's show was provided by The Soaked Lamb, Nora Keys, Costa T, and the T Sisters. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. In this land.